of such a class among financial journalists. Gary Stix among scientific journalists. It is just that prominent media journalism is a thoughtless process of providing the noise that can capture people's attention, and there exists no mechanism for separating the two. As a matter of fact, smart journalists are often penalized, like the lawyer in Chapter 11 who does not care about the truth, but about arguments that can sway a jury whose intellectual defects he knows intimately. Journalism goes to what can capture our attention, with adequate sound bites. Again, my scholarly friends would wonder why I'm getting emotional stating the obvious things about the journalists. The problem with my profession is that we depend on them for what information we need to obtain. Gerontocracy. A preference for distilled thinking implies favoring old investors and traders, that is, investors who have been exposed to markets the longest, a matter that is counter to the common Wall Street practice of preferring those that have been the most profitable and preferring the youngest whenever possible. I toyed with Monte Carlo simulations of heterogeneous populations of traders under a variety of regimes, closely resembling historical ones, and found a significant advantage in selecting aged traders, using as a selection criterion their cumulative years of experience rather than their absolute success, conditional on their having survived without blowing up. Survival of the fittest, a term so hackneyed in the investment media, does not seem to be properly understood. Under regime switching, as we will see in Chapter 5, it will be unclear who is actually the fittest, and those who will survive are not necessarily those who appear to be the fittest. Curiously, it will be the oldest, simply because older people have been exposed longer to the rare event and can be, convincingly, more resistant to it. I was amused to discover a similar evolutionary argument in mate selection that considers that women prefer, on balance, to mate with healthy older men over healthy younger ones, everything else being equal, as the former provide some evidence of better genes. Gray hair signals an enhanced ability to survive. Conditional on having reached the gray hair stage, a man is likely to be more resistant to the vagaries of life. Curiously, life insurers in Renaissance Italy reached the same conclusion by charging the same insurance for a man in his 20s as they did for a man in his 50s, a sign that they had the same life expectancy. Once a man crossed the 40-year mark, he had shown that very few ailments could harm him. We now proceed to a mathematical rephrasing of these arguments. Philostratus in Monte Carlo, on the difference between noise and information. The wise man listens to meaning. The fool only gets the noise. The modern Greek poet C.P. Gavafi wrote a piece in 1915 after Philostratus' adage, "For the gods perceive things in the future, ordinary people things in the present, but the wise perceive things about to happen." Gavafi wrote, "In their intense meditation, the hidden sound of things approaching reaches them, and they listen reverently, while in the street outside the people hear nothing at all." I thought long and hard on how to explain, with as little mathematics as possible, the difference between noise and meaning, and how to show why the time scale is important in judging an historical event. The Monte Carlo simulator can provide us with such an intuition. We will start with an example borrowed from the investment world, as it can be explained rather easily, but the concept can be used in any application. Let us manufacture a happily retired dentist, living in a pleasant sunny town. We know, a priori, that he is an excellent investor, and that he will be expected to earn a return of 15% in excess of treasury bills, with a 10% error rate per annum, what we call volatility. It means that out of 100 sample paths, we expect close to 68 of them to fall within a band of plus and minus 10%, around the 15% excess return, i.e., between 5% and 25%. To be technical, the bell-shaped normal distribution has 68% of all observations falling between minus 1 and 1 standard deviations. It also means that the 95 sample paths would fall between minus 5% and 35%. Clearly, we are dealing with a very optimistic situation. The dentist builds for himself a nice trading desk in his attic, aiming to spend every business day there watching the market while sipping decaffeinated cappuccino. He has an adventurous temperament, so he finds this activity more attractive than drilling the teeth of reluctant little old Park Avenue ladies. He subscribes to a web-based service that supplies him with continuous prices, now to be obtained for a fraction of what he pays for his coffee. He puts his inventory of securities in his spreadsheet and can thus instantaneously monitor the value of his speculative portfolio. We are living in the era of connectivity. A 15% return with a 10% volatility or uncertainty per annum translates into a 93% probability of success in any given year. But, seen at a narrow time scale, this translates into a mere 50.02% probability of success over any given second. Here is the probability of success at different scales table. In 1 year, 93% probability. In 1 quarter, 77% probability. 1 month, 67% probability. 1 day, 54% probability. 1 hour, 51.3%. 1 minute, 50.17%. And 1 second, 50.02%. Over the very narrow time increment, the observation will reveal close to nothing. Yet the dentist's heart will not tell him that. Being emotional, he feels a pang with every loss, as it shows in red on his screen. He feels some pleasure when the performance is positive, but not in an equivalent amount as the pain experienced when the performance is negative. At the end of every day, the dentist will be emotionally drained. A minute-by-minute examination of his performance means that each day, assuming 8 hours per day, he will have 241 pleasurable minutes against 239 unpleasurable ones. These amount to 60,688 and 60,271, respectively, per year. Now realize that if the unpleasurable minute is worse in reverse pleasure than the pleasurable minute is in pleasure terms, then the dentist incurs a large deficit when examining his performance at a high frequency. Consider the situation where the dentist examines his portfolio only upon receiving the monthly account from the brokerage house. As 67% of his months will be positive, he incurs only 4 pangs of pain per annum and 8 uplifting experiences. This is the same dentist following the same strategy. Now consider the dentist looking at his performance only every year. Over the next 20 years that he is expected to live, he will experience 19 pleasant surprises for every unpleasant one. This scaling property of randomness is generally misunderstood, even by professionals. I have seen PhDs argue over a performance observed in a narrow timescale, meaningless by any standard. Before additional dumping on the journalist, more observations seem in order. Viewing it from another angle, if we take the ratio of noise to what we call non-noise, i.e., left column versus right column, which we have the privilege here of examining quantitatively, then we have the following. Over 1 year, we observe roughly 0.7 parts noise for every 1 part performance. Over 1 month, we observe roughly 2.32 parts noise for every part performance. Over 1 hour, 30 parts noise for every 1 part performance. And over 1 second, 1,796 parts noise for every 1 part performance. A few conclusions. 1. Over a short time increment, one observes the variability of the portfolio, not the returns. In other words, one sees the variance, little else. I always remind myself that what one observes is at best a combination of variance and returns, not just returns. But my emotions do not care about what I tell myself. 2. Our emotions are not designed to understand the point. The dentist did better when he dealt with monthly statements rather than more frequent ones. Perhaps it would be even better for him if he limited himself to yearly statements. If you think that you can control your emotions, think that some people also believe that they can control their heartbeat or hair growth. And 3. When I see an investor monitoring his portfolio with live prices on his cellular telephone or his handheld, I smile and smile. Finally, I reckon that I am not immune to such an emotional defect, but I deal with it by having no access to information, except in rare circumstances. Again, I prefer to read poetry. If an event is important enough, it will find its way to my ears. I will return to this point in time. The same methodology can explain why the news, the high scale, is full of noise, and why history, the low scale, is largely stripped of it, though fraught with interpretation problems. This explains why I prefer not to read the newspaper, outside of the obituary, why I never chit-chat about markets, and, when in a trading room, I frequent the mathematicians and the secretaries, not the traders. It explains why it is better to read The New Yorker on Mondays than The Wall Street Journal every morning, from the standpoint of frequency, aside from the massive gap in intellectual class between the two publications. Finally, this explains why people who look too closely at randomness burn out, their emotions drained by the series of pangs they experience. Regardless of what people claim, a negative pang is not offset by a positive one. Some psychologists estimate that the negative effect for an average loss to be up to 2.5 the magnitude of a positive one. It will lead to an emotional deficit. Now that you know that the high-frequency dentist has more exposure to both stress and positive pangs, and that these do not cancel out, consider that people in lab coats have examined some scary properties of this type of negative pangs on the neural system. The usual expected effect, high blood pressure. The less expected, chronic stress leads to memory loss, lessening of brain plasticity, and brain damage. To my knowledge, there are no studies investigating the exact properties of traders' burnout, but a daily exposure to such high degrees of randomness without much control will have psychological effects on humans. Nobody studied the effect of such exposure on the risk of cancer. What economists did not understand for a long time about positive and negative kicks is that both their biology and their intensity are different. Consider that they are mediated in different parts of the brain, and that the degree of rationality in decisions made subsequent to a gain is extremely different from the one after a loss. Note also that the implication that wealth does not count so much into one's well-being as the route one uses to get to it. Some so-called wise and rational persons often blame me for ignoring possible valuable information in the daily newspaper and refusing to discount the details of the noise as short-term events. Some of my employers have blamed me for living on a different planet. My problem is that I am not rational, and I am extremely prone to drown in randomness and to incur emotional torture. I am aware of my need to ruminate on park benches and in cafes away from information, but I can only do so if I am somewhat deprived of it. My sole advantage in life is that I know some of my weaknesses, mostly that I am incapable of taming my emotions, facing news, and incapable of seeing a performance with a clear head. Silence is far better. More on that in Part 3. Chapter 4. Randomness, Nonsense, and the Scientific Intellectual. On extending the Monte Carlo generator to produce artificial thinking, and compare it with rigorous non-random constructs. The science wars enter the business world. Why, the aesthete in me loves to be fooled by randomness. Randomness and the verb. Our Monte Carlo engine can take us into more literary territory. Increasingly, a distinction is being made between the scientific intellectual and the literary intellectual, culminating with what is called the science wars, plotting factions of literate non-scientists against no less literate scientists. The distinction between the two approaches originated in Vienna in the 1930s, with a collection of physicists who decided that the large gains in science were becoming significant enough to make claims in the field known to belong to the humanities. In their view, literary thinking could conceal plenty of well-sounding nonsense. They wanted to strip thinking from rhetoric, except in literature and poetry, where it properly belonged. The way they introduced rigor into intellectual life is by declaring that a statement could fall into only two categories. Deductive, like 2 plus 2 equals 4, i.e., incontrovertibly flowing from a precisely defined axiom framework, here the rules of arithmetic, or inductive, i.e., verifiable in some manner, experiences, statistics, etc., like it rains in Spain, or New Yorkers are generally rude. Anything else was plain unadulterated hogwash. Music could be a far better replacement to metaphysics. Needless to say that inductive statements may turn out to be difficult, even impossible, to verify, as we will see with the black swan problem. And empiricism can be worse than any other form of hogwash when it gives someone confidence. It will take me a few chapters to drill the point. However, it was a good start to make intellectuals responsible for providing some form of evidence for their statements. This Vienna circle was at the origin of the development of the ideas of Popper, Wittgenstein, in his later phase, Carnap, and flocks of others. Whatever merit their original ideas may have, the impact on both philosophy and the practice of science has been significant. Some of their impact on non-philosophical intellectual life is starting to develop, albeit considerably more slowly. One conceivable way to discriminate between a scientific intellectual and a literary intellectual is by considering that a scientific intellectual can usually recognize the writing of another, but that the literary intellectual would not be able to tell the difference between lines jotted down by a scientist and those by a glib non-scientist. This is even more apparent when the literary intellectual starts using scientific buzzwords, like uncertainty principle, Gödel's theorem, parallel universe, or relativity, either out of context or, as often, in exact opposition to the scientific meaning. I suggest reading the hilarious Fashionable Nonsense by Alan Sokol for an illustration of such practice. I was laughing so loudly and so frequently while reading it on a plane that other passengers kept whispering things about me. By dumping the kitchen sink of scientific references in a paper, one can make another literary intellectual believe that one's material has the stamp of science. Clearly, to a scientist, science lies in the rigor of the inference, not in random references to such grandiose concepts as general relativity or quantum indeterminacy. Such rigor can be spelled out in plain English. Science is method and rigor. It can be identified in the simplest of prose writing. For instance, what struck me while reading Richard Dawkins' Selfish Gene is that, although the text does not exhibit a single equation, it seems as if it were translated from the language of mathematics. Yet, it is artistic prose. Reverse Turing Test. Randomness can be of considerable help with the matter, for there is another, far more entertaining way to make the distinction between the babbler and the thinker. You can sometimes replicate something that can be mistaken for a literary discourse with a Monte Carlo generator, but it is not possible, randomly, to construct a scientific one. Rhetoric can be constructed randomly, but not genuine scientific knowledge. This is the application of Turing's test of artificial intelligence, except in reverse.